and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. I am your host, Neil Horwitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJH287, also on LinkedIn, where I post more content. The website, if you're new, is dsmsports.net, where you can find every episode, as well as more content. And of course, subscribe, follow along to the podcast on your preferred podcast platform. Just a fantastic show for you guys today. As I was editing this interview, I was listening back again and again. Just so much good stuff coming out of today's guest. My guest on the podcast today is Rob Gevertz. He is the founder of First 5 Yards. Talks about his time and learnings from Sky Sports, from Talk Sport, from particularly with Manchester City, really helping launch their digital and social media partnerships. Now is doing his thing with consultancy with First 5 Yards. Just such a wealth of knowledge and insight, really getting into the weeds of what it means to value social media content, how to build out partnership content across social, and taking advantage of all the opportunities that a sports team has to blend the emotion of the game and all the natural parts of a game and a sports team in general with potential partnerships, and helping to educate the partnerships team, really getting into the weeds around logo exposure versus true activation of a brand's message. Just so much good stuff. Have a notebook handy, or at least a notepad on your mobile device, because you're going to want to take notes and listen back again. So listen up. Here is Rob Gevertz of First 5 Yards. Back on the podcast with today's guest, and I am so psyched to be able to chat with him. We've had some great discussions already. I'm joined on the podcast today by Rob Gevertz. He is the founder of First 5 Yards, has a crazy cool background, and we're going to get to know him today. Welcome to the podcast today, Rob.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So psyched to pick your brain and learn from you. You have a tremendous wealth of experience and knowledge, and we're going to learn a lot today. But before we get into the meat of our discussion, Rob, tell us about your background. Tell us, you know, how you got into the space, your various stops along the way, and any tips for folks that want to do what you do.
Yeah, so I'm based in London in the UK. I've been working at the intersection of sports and digital kind of media and commercial aspects for about 10, 15 years. I started off a long time ago, actually in a media agency. It was kind of my first real job in London. I was kind of brought in, a friend of mine said, there's a job going here. You basically get to watch TV all day and get taken out for lunch. And that sounded kind of up my street. So did a couple of years at the media agency, moved into more of a sales role for media sales, working at a big newspaper over here in London called Metro, which is a big free newspaper aimed at kind of young professionals, and a really successful product. And that kind of was the first foray. So late 2000s, working over there was when digital started to become more of an important aspect of media and sponsorships within the UK landscape in particular. Following 6-7 really happy years at Metro, I managed to get a role heading up digital partnerships at Sky Sports, the big broadcaster over here in the UK. It was an interesting time, really, because until about a year before I joined, Sky Digital Media had been a completely separate business than Sky Media. And there was a wall in between the two. They didn't talk to each other, and the collaboration wasn't really there. So a big part of the role at that point was kind of bridging that gap and ultimately kind of starting to integrate digital thought process and solutions into a wider sponsorship offering over there at the kind of lead sports broadcaster. Over 3-4 years, I worked at Sky, a similar position over at Talk Sport, which is a big sports radio station here in the UK, and eventually found my way over to an interesting role at Manchester City and the City Football Group at the end of 2015. They, as an entity, were having huge success on the field with their investment from Abu Dhabi, but realised that in order to compete commercially with their peers, who in their mind wasn't just Manchester United and Liverpool, but actually was Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, and some of the kind of bigger sports properties around the world, they need to really be different and focus on innovation and digital in particular, because their fan numbers didn't compete with those other guys. And so they brought in people like myself that had more of a media and partnership background to help try and overhaul their partnerships offering and their kind of commercial operation, both from a kind of sales point of view, but more from a kind of delivery and activation side as well. And so I had a unique role that kind of bridged the gap that most rights holders over here have in between their commercial teams and their digital teams. In most cases, still, unfortunately, they probably don't talk to each other. They have no idea what the other one does. And the product kind of speaks for itself in those days. But with us at City, we were able to really kind of start to deliver great integrated solutions that had digital at the forefront of big international partnerships. And so my remit there covered working with the partnerships teams, along with developing other revenue models and ideas around bringing money in through digital IP and licensing, content syndication, and any other thoughts I could have, really. And just finally got to the end of my time there, right at the end of 2019, start of 2020, and that position, that remit didn't seem to exist anywhere else here in the UK. So I set up my own consultancy, looking to work with rights holders on that kind of digital monetization process. How can they maximize their current assets, access, resource to develop more revenue streams in that kind of sponsorship partnership realm? And as part of that process, I've also partnered with a number of sports technology companies who've got products and services they're trying to sell into sports teams, but kind of have a bit of trouble maybe navigating that landscape over here. So it's kind of a dual front in what the consultancy does. And I've thankfully worked with a variety of interesting partners over the last 3 years or so.
Love it. Just a really, really cool path. And I mean, hell, like yourself, me as well, we've really grown up with the space. I mean, to think that digital partnerships and such specialization and an opportunity to drive significant revenue is now like table stakes today. And 10, 15 years ago was just coming up and maybe off in a throw-in. So to take me back to sort of the evolution of your career. I mean, having started in that more, I guess, for lack of a better term, traditional media, print, and eventually, you know, working with media outlets like Sky and TalkSport and the more quote-unquote like interruptive advertising, like we'll be right back after this ad break or this commercial break. Like how did that evolution come about of going from the more traditional outlet models to digital? Like, were there new metrics that had to be formed? Did you have to really convey the value here? Or was it truly, like, I know for me, it was often just a throw-in with the more traditional, you know, advertising and sponsorship deals. So how was digital treated early on, and what were those early inflection points that made the true value kind of come to life?
Absolutely. So when I first started off in a media agency, digital wasn't really a thing. And so I was a kind of guinea pig for a grad training scheme, looking at doing 18 months, learning about TV and radio, newspapers and magazines, and regional media. So for us, regional radio and regional newspapers, which aren't really a thing anymore. And only really towards the back end of my time at Metro, around the kind of 2010-11, did digital solutions start to creep into the wider media offering. So we were traditionally selling, you know, in my space, I was working more on longer term creative solutions rather than day-to-day ad sales. Mm-hmm. And so much more integrated partnerships. But again, then you had very little understanding of your audience, very little understanding of what creative solutions could be in that space. And it very much took a broad-minded client to start to see the opportunities that these cross-platform solutions could deliver. Because traditionally you were selling to people in very siloed roles, that they were either a print buyer or a strategist or a planner or a digital person, of which there may have been a few within those agencies. And it was only really once you start to go through the kind of early 2010s that the kind of broader conversation started to take place a bit more. So that was starting to happen at Sky. But again, to your point around digital being a throwing or an add-on, that to me, unfortunately, is still the case in a lot of spaces over here, let alone back then 10 years ago. So at Sky, we would have the same thing where someone would come to you with a brief and you'd really have to kind of work hard more internally than externally on changing the way people would typically sell the solutions back to clients because they were only used to the areas they had formerly been working in. So yeah, the sponsorship team were full of people from a broadcast background, from a TV background, rather than thinking more. And that was probably one of the biggest kind of challenges, success stories I had, was around changing the way of thinking into being much more around concept first, platform second. Ultimately, let's sell good ideas and good ways of integrating a brand partner into the subject matter, whether it be soccer or cricket or rugby or whatever, and finding the right avenues to tell their brand story rather than just going, here's a, you know, there's 10 hours of programming a week that you're going to have ad bumpers around, and we're going to add you some, you know, here's a million ad impressions on our website. Let's right. come up with a much more integrated solution. And one of the first things that we did was we were able to kind of sell in a short form digital media campaign and a digital content piece where because there was a situation where a particular client, so it was a car manufacturer, Suzuki, wanted to sponsor one of the kind of flagship TV shows. So they used to have a show that's actually just ended. It's 25 years it was running. It was a program called Soccer AM. It was on a Saturday morning from kind of 10 to 12. And it was a bit like kind of Good Morning Football on the NFL Network. Mm-hmm. Kind of fun, jovial, but even more comedic, even more aimed at the kind of guy waking up on a Saturday morning with a hangover from the night before. And so it had a very kind of UK lad kind of culture around it. The kind of fun, cheeky kind of nature of their comedy with what they did. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately for the client, the show wasn't available. The campaign they wanted to do was a lot shorter than the long-term nature of that. And so instead of going back with the traditional answer of the show's not available for sponsorship, but you can buy some ads in it and we'll find you some online ads that suit a 18 to 25-year-old demographic, I was able to kind of pull back on our sales guys and say, no, there's another way here. We can create some content that takes the ethos of this show. We used some of the presenters from it. We created a kind of look and feel and a narrative that was similar to what the show was typically like, but we're able to shape that much more towards the car and what they wanted to achieve. And it was the first time really that we'd actually used broadcast ads to drive people into a digital space rather than typically being the other way around, where you just would use online to drive tune into a particular TV show. So that would have been in about 2010, 2011. And it was quite a new thing for them at the time, but that kind of format now is, I suppose, it's been the kind of blueprint of what, you know, short form branded content looks like nowadays. And that was a real challenge to try and get the mindset changed internally at a broadcaster like that, to think of, no, we typically work in these kinds of ways and these directions, and actually this is a new thing we can do. And that, I think, really has been one of the things that I've tried to do in most of the stops along the way, the kind of career journey of looking at not focusing on the way things have always been done, but also, is there a better way that we can do things?
Yeah, and I really love the solutions mindset there too, which I think is another paradigm shift that we may not talk quite as much about in the talk about platforms and digital versus traditional, is that like there may have been an inventory menu or we're going to sell X, Y, and Z asset, but you're able to look at an RFP or look at a creative brief and say, okay, you're trying to accomplish this. We can fill you in this slot, or we have this, even this sponsor content slot that we know we're going to sell to somebody, or you can do something a little more bespoke and say, you know, we know what our fans want. We know what we're good at. We know what you're trying to accomplish, and we're going to create something to your example that you spoke to that is, you know, creative, integrated, and it accomplishes something that is good for the partner and good for our fans as well. So like was that solutions mindset? Was that there's a little bit of a hybrid there of, yes, we still have our menu of assets, quote unquote, I'm making finger quotes, you can't see me, a menu of assets that we're going to fill. And like even today with a club, like you may have your starting 11 graphic, your final score, post. So is there a little bit of, yes, we kind of have some things that we know we're going to sell, but then other things where we may create content based on the needs of our partners?
I think it depends on so whether you're talking about it from a publisher side or from a club or a rights holder side. Mm-hmm. So on the publisher side, they would typically have an asset base and they'll be looking to do those, but they will potentially have a bit more flexibility around creating narratives. I think the challenge sometimes is understanding the somewhat dotted line between commercial and editorial, and making sure that everyone's kind of happy in their spaces. That particularly having worked at a newspaper and how strongly the editorial team were behind their beliefs and their ethics around what it is they're writing, that once you start to get into paid editorial advertorials or branded content or whatever you might want to call it now, is sometimes a challenge to try and navigate that landscape and ensure that both parties are happy in that process, that the editorial guys are writing something they're happy to do in a style and a language and an element of openness that retains their editorial beliefs, versus, you know, the brand ultimately paying for something and they want some kind of delivery in those spaces. I think when you look at rights holders now, the challenges for me and where I see almost the biggest opportunity with the offering I have as a consultancy is that in a lot of cases, particularly in Europe, a lot of the clubs don't seem to realize the scale of the opportunity of what assets they actually have that are available in a commercial sense. They just haven't seemed to join the dots around there are 15, 20, 30 kinds of regular narrative that appear day in, day out, week in, week out, whether it is, like you said already, the team announcement, goals, substitutions, tackles, stats. It could be about training, practice. It could be about fitness. It could be anything data or stats related, academy, women's. There's all of these kinds of narratives, and then figuring out how can we maximize the asset, the regular editorial kind of assets that we could be creating suit each of those narratives, let alone then integrating a brand and or creating bespoke branded content in a very separate way to those regular stories. I think that there are huge opportunities for rights holders to create revenue streams by maximizing, like I said before, their existing assets, access and resources to tell those stories that sometimes the guys can't see the wood from the trees because they may be selling the same types of assets they've always sold. And frankly, because most commercial teams are filled with people with years of sports commercial background, but the challenge is to sell that they're selling the same things they did 10 years ago, 15 years ago, whereas the world has kind of moved on a bit, and particularly now where teams are trying to engage on a global level with a global fan base in digital environments. You sometimes need that experience in working within digital environments to understand the best way to maximize what you're currently doing.
Yeah. And take me through your introduction to Man City coming in there. What did they, how far along were they in their maturation of monetizing digital and social? Did they appreciate the value of digital and social? Because I mean, that's something we can go days on as well. Like, what's the value of these platforms, and how do you put a price on something, especially for a brand that is as aspirationally and truly realistically is as global as Man City? You may have something that you can sell to a local partner, but you could also sell it to someone that's trying to reach an entire globe of fans. So like, what does the infrastructure look like for partnerships, and how good was content and partnerships working together when you came in there? How to get better over time? So give us an overview of what Man City looked like and how that represented an opportunity for you as you came in there.
Sure. I don't think it's kind of telling any tales out of school, but things changed a hell of a lot in my time there. In the early days, the conversations would pretty much be as simple as a salesperson coming to you with a contract on behalf of a deal they're trying to sell to a brand and saying, can you add a couple of lines of digital to this? Because typically the way that these deals would have been done, and I dare say are still done in some cases, is the salesperson would find a brand that maybe had some budget available for a sports property. And the conversation would typically go, I hear you're interested in sport. How much money have you potentially got? And the brand may say, we got $1 million. Mm-hmm. And then the salesperson would just put as many bullet points on a contract as possible to try and get the client to spend that $1 million without really any understanding. I would say it's not even about concern. It's understanding of the concepts of things like yield and asset numbers and asset volumes. It wasn't about knowing, are we over or under promising what it is or our ability to deliver. It's just, as a salesperson, my job is to get as much money coming into the business as possible. And so the early days would just be trying to push back on the salesperson to understand a bit more about what do the brand want to do, what's their objectives, how do they work. On a general digital basis, what I would say is that at that point, Man City were very far advanced from a content point of view than any of their competitors. Mm-hmm. They focused a lot on YouTube in the kind of mid 2010s. They were the first, rather than going down a linear TV channel, which some of their peers had done and continue to do, they focused firstly on YouTube and had big success there, and then built out a wider content business around the other platforms, and now have a media department of probably pushing 100 people in a variety of different roles. Wow. But the commercial media function that I was a part of was around that notion of, like I said, bridging the gap between the commercial team, the sponsorship, sales and partnerships team, and the digital team, whether that be the content guys, the social media managers, the digital product teams. My role ultimately was to ensure that we could create as many opportunities for brands to be a part of our whole infrastructure, and ensuring to almost being the commercial voice in the room for any of those non-commercial departments to understand that we were being heard and understood in those spaces. Wow. And over time, yes, a huge part of the role was around developing models, whether it be pricing and valuation models, whether it be just around content strands, commercial content products and services that we could start to have as still a kind of asset-based offering, but just growing our asset value and our asset numbers exponentially. You know, the typical thing at that point from a digital asset point of view or a digital value point of view would be that brands would either have, from a digital solution point of view, they would either get exposure. So we're going to put your logo in as many places as possible within our infrastructure, and you'll get pickup in content in as many places as we can. Or it was branded content, which in those days would be footballers kicking a ball at product X, or footballers playing the FIFA video game whilst chatting about product X. You know, thankfully over time we developed our branded content process to be much better about integrated storytelling, working with outside production companies, much more, you know, stock put into creative execution and glossiness and driving that deeper engagement. But the biggest area of growth actually was the middle ground around sponsored editorial content. How can we credibly integrate a brand into the general narrative of editorial that we're putting out on a regular basis and drive that value? Because we already knew that we would be able to monetize through, you know, YouTube and through Facebook in the ad space, but actually being able to integrate a brand credibly into those things. I did a piece of work and realized after a while that we were sitting on more than $10 million worth of annual inventory that we could be selling to sponsors that no one was touching. And that was just simple things that were going out every day around, you know, they would have content strands such as on this day, goal of the day, happy birthday, player X, here's your five best goals. Or this weekend, we're playing against team X, here's the five best goals against them over the last 10 years. Just simple archive-driven or match highlights, recuts to you know, tell different stories that you could easily find brand partners and just tweak the title or the narrative ever so slightly to fit in with the brand itself, that's going to create infinitely more value than just the basic exposure they've got through happening to be in the background in this particular shot.
Right. Yeah, I want to lean into that, because that's definitely a compelling area of developing those different branded opportunities and really appreciating the difference in value among each of those different opportunities, among the ways a brand can be integrated into a team's content. If you take an auto brand like BMW, you might have a BMW starting 11 graphic. You might have BMW arrivals with players, you know, entering the pitch. You might have an interview where a player is being interviewed inside a BMW while driving it. Therefore, you actually see the product a little more. So how do you go about making sure that the proper value is assigned to each of those different types of integrations and activations? Is it just like, hey, just a logo slap is worth half as much as branded content? Do you take into account how much time is the content team going to need to put into this? How much investment is there? Like, how do you go about figuring out what the right rate is and how it differentiates between each of those different types of opportunities and the value it provides to the partners and the resources it takes for the team to produce it?
Sure. So if I take a step back, first of all, one of the things we desperately tried to do was make sure we were integrating the right brand into the right content piece. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're talking about the best example of that was something like the team announcement, the starting 11, was sponsored by Hayes Recruitment Company. It was all about personnel. And yeah, it formed part of a wider partnership with the team around anything that was personnel or leadership driven, any content. So we created some LinkedIn-based content for them. And that was an asset that I think remains to this day. So you're probably talking 8-9 years they've been on that, because the connectivity is there. And so we would make sure that we would find, you know, we created something called the Midfield Engine, which was just a recut of the match highlights, highlighting in particular midfield play that was sponsored by Valvoline Engine Oils. You know, it's slightly tenuous, but there's a reason, there's a link between the brand and what they want to do and the content and the narrative you want to do. And there's so many narratives that you can create, any brand, where you can create stories around, particularly in the sporting environment. It could be around passion, strength, speed. It could be around emotion, celebrations. There's all these kind of buzzwords that fit in with the basic brand conversations and the marketing conversations that brands want to have, that you can find sporting connotations that connect with each of those that are related to content. So that's kind of what we tried to do was, yeah, instead of just logo slapping and shoehorning, we try and find remotely credible ways of integrating brands into the right areas.
Yeah.
With regards to the value aspect, that's a whole interesting conversation because we, at that point, were working with, well, we were working with Nielsen and we talked to a whole other load of suppliers around valuation tools. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really a fan of any of those at those points because of the level of integration that we were looking to do, to me, didn't fit with where their products were working for. And I'll give you an example of that. So the lead partner in Manchester City was Etihad, the airline. Mm-hmm. And so if we had done, say, a one-minute video highlights piece on YouTube, you know, working with whether it be at that point a company such as Blinkfire or Gum Gum or Nielsen or whatever, any of those AI video valuation tools, that the technology is amazing how they're able to understand how big your logo is, how long it's on screen for, and the equivalent media value of that piece. Mm-hmm. So if we did a one-minute highlights video and they said, and it did a million views, and they said that would be worth X, I don't know, $1,000. We were into year five of a big storytelling piece with Etihad that was all around football fandom in different cities around the world. Those cities were actually the routes they wanted to promote their airline was flying to. We had product placement showcasing the plane in a particular business class and the high quality service that you could get from that. The content itself was produced by external production companies like Vice, for example. So really glossy, high quality, 8 to 14 minute edits with lots of other social cutdowns. What the content didn't have lots of was logos. Mm-hmm. So my question always to these guys would be, if the highlights video did X on a million views and the branded content piece did 500,000 views, what's worth more? And they'd kind of go, well, probably the highlights piece because of the exposure and value on it. Yeah. And I would just be, that can't be right. And so this was kind of when we realized that we're really comparing apples and oranges. And we were the only club really that were pushing this creativity, storytelling, deep integration of brands and driving deeper metrics than just basic logo exposure. And sometimes we found that actually that was a bit more difficult because what I ended up doing was working with a media agency to develop our own weighting system to give what we felt was a true evaluation of each type of content execution that we were doing based around the platform that it went on, based around the level of brand integration, whether it was a sponsored editorial, the basic exposure, whether it was branded content, whether it had product placement in it, the level of engagement that each piece was getting. We just felt that it gave a truer value. And really, we weren't looking for the exact dollar amount. It was more for us to understand that we were pitching the right level of assets to the right brand spending the right amount of money. We didn't want to have a high value asset going to a low value client and vice versa. It just enabled us to understand that these types of assets and these types of content strands, this is our highest value, this is our medium value, and this is our lowest value. What that meant, though, is that we would be going into pitches against other teams and our digital solutions would be 5 or 10x in value what our competition would be offering. And the brand would be like, well, that can't be right. I don't understand how you're offering 10 times the value. And we'd have to keep trying to say, well, that's because we do it differently. And we're offering a much better, frankly, solution than our competition. And it was sometimes a real challenge to try and get people to move out of the way they'd always seen it and always known that, oh, we get for our $1 million, we get 12 Facebook posts. Whereas we're saying, no, we're going to do this huge integrated content solution that's going to be long form, it's short form, there's image, there's lots of brand integration we're going to drive through, there's research off the back of it, all this kind of fully integrated solution that was a real unique proposition. And sometimes clients found it difficult to just compare and contrast with everyone else that was pitching to them at the same time.
Yeah. Is it incumbent on the property to justify the cost for the partner? Like, I mean, to your point, like these metrics, no matter how smart the AI tools are of tracking logos and brand mentions, at the end of the day, like for the partner, they want brand recall, they want new customers. They want new leads for customers. They want sales. And sometimes the only people that know whether that's happening or not, if they even know, are the partners themselves. And so, like, you guys can tell a story and showcase it, whether it's, you know, working with outside agencies or studies or whatnot. Like, ultimately, is it on the clubs to be able to develop the storytelling and be able to say, hey, we have proof that, you know, you're going to have better brand recall, or people are going to think more highly of your brand, regardless of how many, you know, whether it's 2 million or 2 billion impressions. The point is that you're going to drive better outcomes because of the superiority of the content integration and the more organic feel of it. And not just the quote unquote logo slaps or the size of the logo. Like, where does the end goal or end line look like for this? And who's it going to come from? Is it going to come from the partners? Is it going to come from some agency that develops a new tool, a new way to weight things, to your point, like what you developed? Is it going to come from the clubs themselves doing something different? Like, where are we going with all this?
I think there's different ways to look at it, because ultimately the value of something is what someone's willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
And ultimately all you're trying to do in this scenario is create enough ammunition to your argument to justify the price you're asking. And so I don't think there'll be an end result where there's a uniform system that everyone uses that gives, you know, the most up-to-date thing. To be honest, it's no different to how TV viewership has been done for years.
Yeah.
That most people don't really believe the numbers, but everyone's numbers are wrong by the same amount. So you kind of follow it as a trend and you right. get on with it. So I don't think we'll get to a point, even though there are companies out there that have expanded on the valuation model and offering that seems to be slightly more robust, and maybe work on a project by project rather than this overall nature of being able to value someone's entire inventory. But I do think that we are, the clubs are starting to get smarter, but they kind of need to, because they're trying to position themselves a lot at times as a publisher. You've only got to look at what Barcelona are doing now, trying to kind of build this media house as a way of creating a much bigger revenue stream for them now. But the reality is, if you're going to act like a publisher, you need to be a publisher. And by that, you need to have all of those other back-end abilities, like you say, around data and around research and around managing those executions, whether it be from a production or a delivery point of view, to ensure that you are you're comparing and competing against some of the big traditional sports publishers in the market.
Yeah. No, this is brilliant stuff and really well put. And a few minutes left here with Rob Gebbertz. He's founder of First 5 Yard Digital Sports Consultancy. Just really awesome stuff. And I want to talk briefly about just the international nature of a club like Man City, or just soccer clubs, football clubs in general. How, like, a single player acquisition, a single transfer can just completely change the game, so to speak. I mean, yeah, a Premier League title, I'm sure, goes a long way. Champions League appearance or title goes a hell of a long way as well. Viral posts go a long way. But when you're thinking about, hey, we now have a player from this country or that country, this is going to now extend our reach more, even more so. Like, how much does the composition of the fan base, how much does the global clout of the players themselves, each individual, affect what partners are the club is willing to pay or willing to ask for when it comes to digital assets? Is it ultimately just, you know, the club's platforms and their channels and their reach? Or do you look at things like the composition of the fan base, the composition of the players, the reach of the players and their own individual platforms? Like, how does it all end up working together so that, you know, like I said, a single transfer can completely upend things in a good way?
Yeah, I think it's almost like a two-phased approach. So yes, absolutely, fandom, you know, or the fan interest is driven a lot by players and who joins and where they're from. I think you have to understand that outside of the core local fan base around, let's say, the Premier League and their teams, the reality is that most of their fans, from a digital point of view, are international. Mm-hmm. And so the international fans generally follow players more than teams, or they'll follow a variety of teams that normally are driven by players in those kind of spaces. The challenge for teams is to try and capitalize on those moments where the sporting side of things presents opportunities from a marketing point of view. So you buy a player. The biggest examples are obviously what's happened in the MLS and what's happened in the Saudi Pro League.
Yeah.
With regards to the major acquisitions of Messi and Ronaldo. But taking a step down from that and looking at some of the more kind of longer term things that have happened, you look at an example of Tottenham Hotspur in London, who have the captain of the South Korean national team, Kim Min Son, and he's, you know, the fan base that he has from that part of the world is rabid, and the club do a very good job of trying to maximize the commercial opportunities around activating in that market. But it does require you, if it is a long-term marketing play, then there are some basic building blocks you need to put into place to ensure that you're able to capitalize on that market over the long term, particularly as and when that player doesn't play for you anymore. So finding ways to build official fan clubs and engaging regularly, creating content in that localized language and formats, working maybe with specific social platforms in those countries that are unique to that market rather than maybe some of the bigger, you know, global or US-based ones. There are some aspects you kind of need to do. Sometimes clubs will engage with specialist agencies either on the ground or just global international content agencies that specialize in doing that and capitalizing on that. And then the challenge is absolutely around how can you monetize that audience and that fan base, whether it be through content specifically or partnerships looking to activate. You know, it's no secret, I think, that one of Tottenham's main commercial partners is a partner because a huge part of their business activities take place in South Korea and in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. So having an ability to leverage the two parts of that brand together over in that market are very key. So there's differing ways that you can be monetizing, from big brand long-term conversations to short-term quick wins in the content space and kind of building that credibility in those markets.
Yeah. Is it like, are you just kind of taking a swing that, hey, we now have the opportunity to build a fan base in Korea or out here in the States? We have like Shohei Ohtani, a Japanese superstar that played for the Angels, who may want to, you know, target fans in Japan with their partnership opportunities. Like, and you create these platforms, you create that localized content, you work with maybe some of those agencies to create that, you know, localized language specific content. And then do you just kind of hope that the day that player leaves, that those fans stick with you and all that investment is not for naught? I mean, obviously you're making some hay and making some revenue in the meantime with those partnerships, but is it kind of like, are players not mercenaries, but are you activating through players and then doing your best to develop fan bases of your brand, of your team, in the hopes that when that player leaves someday, that those fans will still stick with you? Is it ultimately an investment that you're kind of making a bet in that sense?
I think there's definitely a case of that. I think the realities are that you cannot build your commercial business off of individual players because they change around so often. So there needs to be an element of long-term thinking. But I think now is a time where you can start to make those inroads and see if there's a long-term, use it as a springboard to a long-term conversation with a fan base. I'll be interested to see what the NBA and the Spurs in particular do in France, kind of starting now with Victor Wembanyama arriving and using that. You know, obviously there's a game now that takes place in Paris every year as part of the NBA, and seeing whether there's a longer term conversation that could be had from a marketing and a commercial point of view with France and the wider kind of Northern European region, and looking at kind of taking learnings from, I don't know, what maybe Denver does in Serbia or what Dallas does in Croatia, I'm going to say, hopefully not getting my knowledge wrong there with yeah. Luca, and some of those other countries, and seeing kind of where they can kind of you know, have success both now and then building that long term conversation. I suppose in the way that up until recently, the Houston Rockets had done in China. Obviously, things happened at that point with that relationship, but they had built a foundation that lived on beyond Yao Ming playing for the Rockets. And so it's kind of, what can you do that, even if you have 2 or 3 years of uber success because the player's there, how can you turn that into a 20, 30 year conversation with a fan base?
No, that's really good examples there for sure. And when it comes to players being the conduit, because I mean, oftentimes players have a bigger platform than the clubs even, and it's not always the case, obviously. And these clubs are huge brands, a huge global brands in and of themselves. Is there a balance of even activating through players. Like, I say all this because we have this conversation sometimes when I talk to NBA folks and the just the clout of NBA players of, hey, like, we are going to do a feature that is, you know, an interview with X player, but that player may not want to take the time to do it. They may want extra money to do it, and maybe that's built into their salary. Maybe it's not. But they're monetizing their own brands themselves. They have their own deals. You know, they instead of taking the time to do something with the club, they could be taking the time to do something themselves with their own agents or their own managers and their own partners. Like, is there a little bit of balance of that? Or did you guys ever run into that with Manchester City, or have you seen with other clubs or other clients that you work with, where you have to balance the asks and the amount of time you're asking players to put into these content activations? Or is it not really a concern because most of it doesn't really involve needing the players' time and resources themselves?
So there's a lot to unpack there. So what I would say, first of all, is it depends on the level of team and sport and player that you're talking about and how much almost power they have individually. So at the very top, so I can only speak from personal experience at Man City, the players are contracted as part of the, you know, to do a certain amount of work on behalf of corporate partners of the club. Now, some are more kind of on the front foot in doing those, and some are very lazy, to say the least, and it can be a challenge. However, what you also find is that brands may come and do a club deal where they hope, particularly in a certain region, it may be a lot cheaper for a brand. Let's say Gillette, who want to do a big campaign in Brazil with a Brazilian soccer player, it may be cheaper for them to do a regional deal with a team to try and get access to that player than to do a personal endorsement deal with the player themselves. So there may well be ways around that. And whilst the team would never necessarily 100% guarantee that all of your activity is going to be focused around that player, because you can't, you know, a team deal will have to use a minimum of three players in any kind of comms and activation. Yeah. But you would always, the brand would always lean on the club to say, look, can we please have this player as part of it? You know, you put in a request and whatever else. Mm-hmm. So there are ways and means to kind of make everyone happy in those spaces. As you start to move down the ranks, though, I think the realities are that players are more than happy to do any commercial deal that they're kind of told to and asked to do, because the money starts to become more valuable to them in those kind of elements. So I'm doing some work and have been doing, there's been a lot of talk around women's soccer in particular over here. Mm-hmm. And the women's teams are a lot more open to a lot more commercial work, but in particular a lot more integration of brands and commercial aspects into it, because they see the value in telling the story generally of the sport, and they're becoming kind of pioneers and trailblazers for the sport. And so there's very rarely as much pushback on not doing stuff, because they see the wider picture of these are things that we should be doing to grow the interest and understanding of us as sports people in this arena.
Yeah. No, I love those insights and that example. One more quick question for you, Rob, before we get to this episode's charitable stat. I could seriously sit here and just pick your brain all day on this stuff. And I want to get into kind of like where the future of monetizing digital and social is going. I think we're starting to get more direct fan relationships. And just really looking at the localization aspect of these global clubs in particular, like you're starting to slice and dice fan bases in some ways where, you know, if I'm following a Bayern Munich, for example, or Barcelona, there might be an English account. There might be a US-based account. There might be a Chinese-based, a Mandarin-based account. There might be a, you know, Portuguese-based account. And it might only be on Twitter. And then maybe they have more global accounts on TikTok. Maybe they don't. Are you ultimately going after global partnerships, or is there a bit more of a fragmented way of looking at fan bases of like, yeah, we have this. This is what our, you know, our English speaking, activation or content looks like. This is our Mandarin content. Like, how do you go? Because I think it's so not unique to global football. Like, we're starting to get some of that more out here in the States with more language or country specific accounts. But how did that work for you guys at Man City as those became more bigger and bigger platforms and kind of again like slicing dicing those fan bases to some degree?
Yes, so they had marketing objectives on an international basis that meant that they required to have localized content in 7, 8, 9 different languages. Mm-hmm. And they also, that would be driven by their marketing objectives and the desires to try and maximize footprint and ultimately monetization opportunities in certain key markets. But those key markets may also be dictated by the players, like we said before. At the end of the day, they had an opportunity for a while in Northern Africa because they had a player from Morocco that had a big fan base. Mm-hmm. And so that opened up an avenue and a direction. And so they started to create content and maybe run a language account in a different language they would have done before. They were a unique club that they had the resources to be able to do that all in-house, whereas a lot of other big teams utilize third-party agencies to run social accounts and create content in more localized environments. From a commercial point of view, the clubs, I think, see this as a twofold opportunity. A, to kind of absolutely monetize and try and bring brands into the space and capitalize on the kind of opportunity that a local market could provide them, whether it be because of the players they've got there or just knowing that it's an important market for people. But secondly, I think just doing regional partnerships is a great way of creating a pipeline to try and grow those into global partners. So yeah. It's just a way of, I wouldn't say it's a try before you buy, but it's an easier long-term sales conversation to say, oh, you know, come and work with us in this core market. And then, you know, the salesperson has a year, 2 years to kind of have a run at the client for a longer, bigger global partnership that ultimately is going to be worth more money for them. So there's a variety of reasons why I think that side. Where I think is really interesting is where technology is coming in now and looking at how you can start to automate a lot of those processes around localization of content and looking at but what that means from an IP point of view and from a kind of player and a talent point of view. So where you've got now, for example, one of the big challenges used to be particularly regional deals, you asked players just to speak lines to camera. It was the cheapest, easiest way to create bespoke content, quote unquote, for a brand. Mm-hmm. More often than not, though, that's you're asking players to say things maybe that aren't in their native language. And mm-hmm. So actually, if there is an ability for a player to speak to camera in their native language, but you can create 15 variations of that in a video and audio format through AI and technology.
Yeah.
I think this is a really interesting development that does pose some legal and contractual potential problems around players maybe not wanting, you know, about the argument of did I say that or not and whether it could be misconstrued or whatever else, I don't know. But I just think it's an interesting potential step down the road that will create huge efficiencies for clubs if they can do that and then go, you know, you could take it through to the nth degree with individual personalized messaging for every one of your 2, 5, 10 million digital fans that follow you and start to create really hyper-localized, hyper-personalized content. But a lot of the building blocks need to be put in between now and then that frankly, most teams outside of the top 4 or 5 in the Premier League just aren't set up to deliver at the moment.
Yeah. No, as you were talking about that, my wheels are spinning just thinking about all those opportunities. I was thinking about, like, you know, the fact that Mr. Beast, you look at him and he's starting to use, and other creators of that ilk are starting to use AI to be able to instantly create all of his videos again in Spanish, in whatever language, and you have a whole other fan base that, you know, yeah, could have watched you with captions before, but now can get a whole different, more unique, authentic experience, and just opens up so many new fan bases. So to think about how that could, you know, make its way into sport, you know, the issues and contract agreements and rights aside, that's always going to be a sticking point with the slow moving nature of sport. But just really interesting stuff to think about as it only gets better and better and more fun for folks like you in the partnership space and the digital sports space and. Certainly better for us as fans to be able to experience these things.
Absolutely.
Oh, man, Rob, seriously enjoyed this conversation. We're having some more fun with you, though, coming up with our quick take segment. But first, this episode's shareable stat coming up right now. So much good stuff from Rob Gebbertz, founder of First 5 Yards. Just phenomenal insight, tons of great learnings. And stick around because in the quick hitting question segment, I will tell you, this is one of our more substantive of segments with Rob sharing a ton more insight as well. Interesting information about the UK and just so much good stuff. So stick around for that. But first, this episode's shareable stat. This is a shareable stat looks at WhatsApp. You know, we depending on when you're listening to this, the Formula One race in Las Vegas was very recent. and the Mercedes team actually had a new partnership that was getting activated and getting publicity around the event, and that was a partnership with WhatsApp. They are one of many now to launch a broadcast channel on WhatsApp. If you go on WhatsApp, you can find many broadcast channels. There was also a recent article from Neiman Lab looking at broadcast channels and the use by newspapers and news outlets, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, The Guardian, et cetera, et cetera. And the stat is that the Mercedes F1 team has, as of right now, 830,000 followers for their WhatsApp broadcast channel. And that has grown over the past couple days. Depending on when you're listening to this, it's right after the Las Vegas race for Formula One. And Mercedes, of course, grows each race as they put more content out there and get more discovered and get shared more. And 830,000 followers is pretty not a ton compared to their Twitter following. If you look at MLB, for example, MLB has a broadcast channel as well. They have 1.2 million followers compared to around 11.3 on Twitter as of right now. And it's a platform to keep an eye on, though, because you've seen the publicity. You've seen even Mark Zuckerberg talk about WhatsApp and its importance to the future of Meta and the future of the overall ecosystem within Meta. And we always know one thing that to keep in mind is that when Meta PR, when they start doing articles and putting statements out there, there's a reason. It means they're going to be prioritizing those platforms and trying to push more organic reach there, more opportunity there, more ads there, of course, as well. So what does that mean for you? Well, it may be maybe not time to start a WhatsApp broadcast channel right away, but it also could be. And because it's a place where you want to encourage people to have notifications turned on, that means you're not going to necessarily spam them. So you don't have to think about putting every tweet there, every Instagram story there. It's really reserved for the best of the most shareable stuff. Yes, right now there's no two-way engagement, like similar to IG broadcast channels, of course, but except on WhatsApp, which is a little more international, a little more based around messaging compared to Instagram. It's a place where you can have reactions. There's no two-way conversation. There's no spammy or trolling comments or anything like that to worry about keeping an eye on. And it's a place where people are often forwarding conversations, forwarding content to their chats, to the WhatsApp chats they have going. So you can put some shareable content there as well. And if you look at what MLB is doing, what Mercedes is doing, they're doing a good job of putting some of that curated best of content there. Really interesting place to keep an eye on. I would encourage you to go out and check it out. Follow a couple of channels. Check out what the sports teams are doing. Check out what the outlets are doing. Check out what all the platforms are doing that are active on there that seem to have success. The engagement seems to be pretty solid compared to other platforms. And again, when Meta is pushing something, that's usually a good sign that it's a place that you start to look at also. So that's a real shareable stat. Again, that's 830,000 followers right now for the WhatsApp broadcast channel for Mercedes F1 team. And always good to also check out a team that is partnered with the platform, because that means they're going to be getting fed some of the best practices, some of the things that Meta wants to showcase for others and have others emulate what they're doing. So check it out, think about it, ponder it, but more importantly, stick around for more good stuff with Rob Gebertz of First 5 Yards. Right back in the podcast with Rob Gebertz of First 5 Yards. Now ready for some quick takes. Rob, you kicked ass in our interview, learned so much. Are you now ready to take on the quick takes?
I hope so. We'll see. Ask me again at the end. We'll see how we get on.
Right. Number one, this will be an easy one, probably, but a little nostalgic. Tell me, what was your first ever job? Not necessarily like the first quote-unquote like professional job after university or whatever. The first work you got paid for, no matter how young you were.
Yeah, so it's a good one. So my first job was in a sports goods store in East London. I was about 13, 14, working in the summer vacation. And it was, in those days, they called it like a sports outfitter. So they sold real equipment like soccer cleats, cricket equipment. It wasn't like leisure wear and fashion stuff. It was real proper equipment, and it was the kind of place where West Ham United, who were local, used to come in every summer and get all of the cleats for all the players that didn't have individual deals. So every year the kit man would come in and kind of go, right, I need 8 pairs of Adidas World Cups in a size 7, 9 pairs in an 8, and so on and so forth. And it was the location where David Beckham bought his first ever pair of soccer boots, because 1 year after I'd left there, but 1 year he came back with the first set of Adidas Predators off of the line and kind of presented it as the kind of BR launch in kind of the early 2000s. So, yeah, Sedgwick Sports Shop in Walthamstow, East London. It was a staple of that kind of thing. It was awesome.
That is so cool. I'm glad I asked that question. What a really cool first job experience for sure. That's awesome. All right, number two for you, Rob. Tell me, you may have brought this up already, maybe not. Tell me your favorite digital or social media campaign that you helped work on or put together during your career so far.
I think it was when I was at Manchester City, and I was responsible for the broadcast rights for our women's Champions League series. So it was the first time the women's team had got into the European Champions League, the UEFA Champions League. And so I was tasked with going out to the broadcasters and trying to sell the rights. And the reality was this was 2017, and there just wasn't any interest. We were barely getting any offers at all, let alone it may have been, oh, we'll pay for production and that's it. Kind of, they won't give you a fee. Wow. And so I realized that at that time, Facebook Live was becoming a thing, and we had enough resources internally that we were starting to film games. And I thought, actually, I went to our content team and our production team and kind of posed the idea of, what about if we self-produced it and self-distributed it on our Facebook page, and we got sponsors integrated instead. And we made the money, you know, we created the revenue stream through sponsorship rather than through broadcast rights. And that's what we did. And so the fact that we produced it ourselves meant that we could create many more ways to integrate the sponsor, and then we could create shoulder content to drive up the value of the partnership as well and create more inventory for them. So we ended up selling it to Nissan as a car brand, and they took the first game as a trial and then effectively signed on for 2 years afterwards because it went really well, and we probably got 5x what we were offered as a kind of a broadcast rights fee. So it was a kind of win-win for everybody. And again, it helped, I think, a lot internally in kind of understanding the opportunity that the digital platforms could offer.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. I mean, to see how digital has really helped elevate women's sport as well. And I mean, to think how far women's sport has come too. I mean, certainly overseas as well as here in the U.S., it's just it's only getting bigger and bigger, and digital has been a huge driver of it. So that's a really cool story. Love that.
Cool.
Number three for you, Rob. Tell me the most memorable game you've been at in person, whether it's for work or as a fan. What's the most memorable match you've been at?
So I am an Arsenal season ticket holder. Have been since I was probably 5 years old. I would guess There's two games that stand out. There was a game, 1998. Arsenal won the Premier League. It was the first time they'd won it in 7 years under their new French manager, Arsene Wenger, playing a really exciting brand of football. And they won their last home game. It was 4-0. And it was just a kind of a real... Because there was no kind of drama in the game. They scored two goals quite early on in the game, knew that we were going to win, and it was a real kind of celebration. And so it was kind of a fun day. The other game, though, was actually 2006. Arsenal got to the final of the European Champions League, the UEFA Champions League. And actually the semi-final was away in Spain at a team called Villarreal. And Arsenal were winning 1-0 going into the last minute. And then they conceded a penalty kick. And so I'd managed to go to a lot of the away games in that season. And so the kind of misery that struck of, oh, they've gone and thrown it away now, kind of the last kick of the game, and we've wasted all this time and money, and they're just going to throw it away. And the goalkeeper saved the penalty. And so that was probably the most crazy I've ever gone in any sporting moment, because typically when a goal goes in, you're kind of at a medium level of emotion going up to a high. But at this point, we were so low and devastated. And then he saved it, and we just, I mean, that was kind of blacking out for 20 seconds, kind of craziness. It was awesome.
What an adrenaline rush. That's so amazing. I got to ask you, because out here in the States, we don't have quite the same, opportunity to win multiple titles during a given season. I mean, as the NBA is launching their in-season tournament this year, so that'll be something they're trying to emulate what you all do in Europe. So, like, as a fan of Arsenal, and I'm also an Arsenal fan, go Gunners. What is the level of anticipation or joy or desire when it comes to winning a Premier League title? When it comes to winning an FA Cup, even, or Community Shield, or Champions League title? Like, what's the kind of the ranking of what is best, or does it not really matter? You just want to collect trophies.
So without getting into a big existential conversation around American sports and having a season long and not having the best team at the end of the season necessarily win, I think that it really does depend, I think, on your team and kind of where you are in your growth process. I think ultimately the winning the Premier League is the best indication of you have been the best team for the entire season, because ultimately you play 38 games and whoever wins the most games or accrues the most points over those 38 games is the champion. The Champions League is the highest quality tournament of the lot, and it is still feels super special to be in it and to be competing in that, to be known as ultimately the best team in Europe and probably the world. But then some of those cup competitions are more about just the individual day and the joy that comes from success on a day rather than having to be the best team overall. It doesn't matter about whether who's the higher ranked team going into those individual cup games and cup competitions. I think you only actually need to look at the Welcome to Wrexham documentary that gives you a bit more of an insight into what it means to the lower ranked teams to play in these competitions. And again, because of the closed networks of American sports, you don't really get that outside of kind of the US Open Cup in soccer. Yeah. You don't really have, you know, it would be great to have like a double A team playing a three game series at a major league park, or having the Yankees come to God knows where in the middle of Indiana playing a single A team in a series of that meant something rather than it just being an exhibition. It's a really interesting experience for everyone involved in that process on both sides. So I think that's something where European sport has that over the American sports. You don't get that. Everything is really just set up to the playoffs, which then why bother playing the season in the first place? If you're just going to go into a playoff, it doesn't really kind of mean a huge amount, particularly if you're playing 162 games. Kind of what's the point after July?
Totally. A very nuanced, sensible response to the end. Certainly during the MLB playoffs, that came up quite a bit in for Major League Baseball with, you know, maybe the worst team in terms of making the playoffs end up going to the World Series. So it's definitely an interesting conversation for sure. On number four for you, Rob, tell me the number one tip you give to someone that wants to work in professional sport. If someone asks you, hey, I want to work in sports, what would you tell them?
I think if you are on the kind of content editorial production side, just do it. Just make stuff. There's no barriers to entry. Get out there, do it, make your own stuff, and that will, once you then have something to help you kind of get noticed by the big clubs or the big organizations, those spaces. From a commercial point of view, I'm biased, but obviously I think the digital is kind of the future of where things need to be going commercially in the sports business. And so understanding the landscape and what you can offer these teams or these sports organizations within that space to ultimately find and deliver them better results in those spaces is going to be key. So looking at how you can ultimately learn more about someone's audience and deliver those results, I think it's going to be key.
Yeah, no, very good advice on both fronts. I mean, the opportunity to create and nothing stopping you from starting today. And then on the other front too, of especially as these new platforms emerge, as Metaverse, as you know, even TikTok is not new anymore, but you can become the expert in that, because there are no, when something new comes out, there are no experts yet. And so if you can become an expert, you have all of a sudden have a very, very valuable you know, set of knowledge to give to a potential employer, to a potential club. That's great. All right, number five, we didn't get into the weeds on individual platforms quite as much, so I'm going to get into it a little bit now. Tell me, if I say you're going to get to buy stock in one of any of the social media platforms for the next 10 years, which one are you buying stock in and why? You know, we talked about YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, any of the above, WhatsApp. Which one are you buying stock in for the next 10 years and why?
I don't really know is the honest answer. It's such a weird space right now that I think if anything, maybe whether this class is a social network, is YouTube. Yeah. Just because I think that I'm really interested in the creator space and looking at how people are kind of developing their own audiences and becoming their own publishers and media houses. And actually though, YouTube and kind of long form YouTube becoming the catalyst for actually deeper or broader short form content and monetization opportunities. So the example for that may be the New Heights podcast with the Kelce brothers.
Yeah.
But actually, the success of that is not necessarily the podcast and the YouTube, but it's the social clips and the cut-ups.
Yeah.
I think that their engagement will be huge in the social space rather than the long form, but you need to do the long form to have the social stuff. So that kind of environment, I think, is really important. And actually, the kind of convergence of media, and that people aren't just podcasters nowadays. Like I said, your podcast is videoed and creates in all these other areas. So the kind of convergence into kind of mixed media offerings rather than being on an individual platform, to me, is actually, if I could buy stock in that, is that that's the kind of thing for me. Is it's not about the platform, it's about the actual concepts and the content, and ensuring that goes out into as many relevant places as possible.
Yeah, that's really, really well put. Like, it's not about itemizing like this individual, you know, post here, post there. It's really buying into the whole thing they're producing, and all the different ways that gets packaged, you know, across these various platforms, depending on how a fan may want to consume it. Just great stuff. And I love that as an example. All right, number six for you. We're going to have some fun here. Put our traveler hat on. I enjoy traveling. You've been around a little bit too. Tell me your favorite place you travel to in the world and the place you haven't been yet but want to.
Favorite place to travel? I've been to see cricket in South Africa, which is an amazing place and territory to go to. I actually just got back from Seville yesterday to watch a Champions League game, which is a great day and a half in a city there. I've been quite fortunate to travel a little bit around European soccer. And I've been to the States a few times. So I think you can't beat the environment of a kind of day or an evening at a ballpark, major league ballpark, and just the experience of that, where the game itself is kind of secondary to just the overall kind of match going experience and the atmosphere and the food and everything. So something like that. As far as kind of bucket list stuff, I think I'd still love to go to Augusta. I think it would be an amazing experience. I don't know how I'd deal without being on my phone for 8 hours. I think it would be a challenge, but we'd see. And Australia. I think going to see a sporting event in Australia, particularly, you know, cricket or rugby, is one. Particularly maybe, say, with something your audience may or may not be familiar with, the British Lions, which is a touring team made up of the best rugby players from England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland that go on a tour every 4 years. They go to either Australia, New Zealand or South Africa. So it's kind of a 12-year round robin kind of thing. And so that, as a kind of like traveling circus, is it looks an amazing experience from the outside.
Oh, that all sounds really cool. I didn't know about the British Lions. That's awesome. And yeah, certainly we love, you know, the Masters out here in Augusta and all the various traditions around there, and, you know, the cheap egg salad sandwiches and pimento cheese sandwiches, whatever it might be. And it's good stuff all overall.
Absolutely.
All right, number seven for you, Rob. Tell me, this you can go as long or as short. This can be a one-word answer. It can be an extended answer. Will the Super League ever come to reality? And if so, when?
It depends on what you mean by Super League. I think ultimately, I think what UEFA are doing and the changes they're making to the Champions League is becoming a de facto Super League anyway. So there's not, and actually, it probably was just bad PR that kind of cut out the Super League previously anyway. Fundamentally, the challenge is American owners that are used to a closed shop moving into a European environment where everyone wants and needs to have promotion and relegation. And how can you find the best compromise to keep everyone happy? That ultimately will be whatever a Super League will become, will be that compromise.
Yeah, I think that's the right answer. I actually just finished reading the club myself about the formation of the Premier League and some of the stories they're in, and it definitely it gets you thinking. Like, why is Brentford and Nottingham Forest getting the same, you know, cut of the media rights deal as we are, or whatever it might be, and the ways that these more elite clubs just want us to play each other. And we're seeing that play out in college football out here in the States. And yeah, like I said, the Super League is in some form is already starting to take place. And so it might be the wrong way to frame it, perhaps. All right. Time for our food question, Rob. Number eight, always got to ask our food question. So tell me, if I go come out there and we hang out and maybe go to an Arsenal game, tell me the best meal to get in all of, you know, the greater London area, the best meal to get and where to get it.
I mean, wow, that's a podcast in itself. I think that the boring answer for me, and this is based really around the pre-game for us, is based on where we go to the stadium, where we park the car, whatever else. There is a fish and chip shop on the corner of Gillespie Road, near to the Arsenal train station, that is frequented on a regular basis. And their chips are hot and fresh. And that's probably kind of that and some of the other kind of vendors outside. I think that's the challenge that we have over here, is that we do not have the quality of kind of local vendors that you guys might have at stadiums around there. They just haven't embraced the local communities and those kind of aspects. And being frank, for most people, this isn't necessarily me, but for most people, beer is more important than the food. So that's probably more of the pre-game routine for a lot of people. It's more about which pub are you going to stand and drinking.
The beer is definitely important, but yeah, there are some folks that will go to a game out here in the States just because they want to sample some of the food, and it's definitely becoming a bigger and bigger part of the game day experience, is getting to get some of that awesome food at these stadiums and arenas and ballparks. Definitely a good call out there. But hey, fish and chips is cool to me before a match, for sure. All right, number 9 for you, Rob, coming down to the end here with Rob Gebert's up first 5 yards. Tell me the digital or social first sports media outlet, assuming there is one, kind of the social first sports media outlet in Britain that we should all know about. You know, out here we have, you know, various publications that are coming up, whether it's, you know, Overtime or Barstool or Bleacher Report. Like, is there something out there in Britain that we should all be aware of?
There's a couple of things I'll draw your attention to. So again, kind of harping back to the Welcome to Wrexham proposition, there's a part of this series where they brought a goalkeeper out of retirement to be part of their team in their push for promotion. He's a guy called Ben Foster, who played for many years in the Premier League. He played for Manchester United, and he played for England for a few times. And so during the initial coronavirus lockdown, he set up a YouTube channel that brought together his two passions of football and goalkeeping and cycling. So the Cycling GK was born as a goalkeeper, but it's kind of morphed into an ongoing kind of media proposition that combines. He would create some really good match day vlogs where actually he'd be taking GoPros into the kind of behind the scenes of a match day environment in the changing room at the practice facility. He'd even put the GoPro inside of his goal in the games that he was allowed to show you and give you a real kind of behind the scenes thing. He now has a running podcast as part of the Ringer podcast network with Spotify, and is kind of building out a wider kind of content output. So I'm like I said before, I'm interested in this kind of new wave of creators, and he for me is one of the guys at the forefront of that. The other thing just to be aware of is that we had a couple of months ago this huge YouTube creator event headlined by a group called the Sidemen, one of whom you may have heard of is the kind of leader or biggest name guys, KSI, friends of Logan Paul, guys behind Prime Hydration and of boxing fame. But this kind of content group, the Sidemen, and their kind of associated friends created a charity soccer match that took place at the West Ham Stadium in London. They sold out 60,000 seats in no time at all. Wow. And the live stream did phenomenal, like millions of concurrent viewers and hundreds of millions of combined views, probably billions of views, bearing in mind the nature of the people that so included Mr. Beast was part of this process. So it's just an event to look out for year on year, the Sidemen charity game, as a kind of example of these are guys with humongous audiences and rabid fan bases that are really super engaged. And, you know, they are able to create, you know, thankfully this was a charity event, but the monetization opportunities around these kind of things and looking at what the YouTuber boxing and those kind of areas are as well. It's an interesting space that I just kind of look at from the outside and in awe a little bit and interested to see kind of what the next incarnation is. I know they're already thinking about next year and what the game's going to look like and how they can kind of better it from a size point of view. They kind of went from 2 years ago, they played the game in a stadium in London that held about 25,000. This time, 60,000, they sold that out quickly. I think the hope is to go to Wembley, which is 90,000. Wow. But then what does the digital and content output look like after that as well?
Holy, well, some really good call outs there. I mean, the trend of athlete led content is certainly a part of that with Ben Foster. Then, and yeah, I mean, I'm waiting for, I guess, you know, KSI coaching a squad against like Logan Paul or Jake Paul's squad or something. Who knows? It's just the sky.
Well, I mean, keep your eyes peeled because I know that there's stuff like that is being talked about. So yes, you may have heard it here first, put it that way.
Very cool stuff to keep an eye on. All right, last one for you, Rob, before we get out of here. Tell me the sport besides football, besides soccer, that you buy stock in for England's pro sports for the next 20 years. I know we work with some at my company. We work with some pro sports leagues in England of up-and-coming sports. Is there a sport besides football that you'd buy stock in for England's pro sports for the next 20 years?
So there's two. One, unsurprisingly, is the NFL. And interesting just to see the continued growth over here, particularly now with flag being part of the Olympics, what that means over here would be an interesting one. The other one actually is basketball, and in particular the British Basketball League. So they had investment from 777 Partners, they are big parts of the London Lions is I think one of the biggest teams over here. They regularly play in the EuroLeague, the FIBA EuroLeague, and they've recently sold rights to, I know, some US regional sports networks to the British Basketball League games. So interested to see the kind of continued development of that goes. Obviously, it's a sport that's kind of primed for a young digitally native audience. And so now they've got some kind of decently experienced people working behind the scenes. Interested to see kind of what that growth looks like over the next 5 years.
Oh, some great ones there, man. You're full of knowledge, Rob. I love this. This is awesome. So that now, because you kicked ass in the quick takes, your chance to take over the podcast and tell us your social media all-star to follow. Just tell us who they are, what platform they're on, and why they're worth following.
So I think for me, there's a guy that's been doing a lot of work over the last 2 or 3 years in really trying to educate and kind of integrate the kind of sports social landscape over here in the UK. So there's a gentleman by the name of Scott Goodacre who runs a handle called The Online Rule. And so it's a really good resource for best practice. He does a great survey looking at kind of particularly the social media teams of UK sports to kind of find out and understand some trends and some interesting kind of aspects of their kind of day-to-day role. So Scott himself is a freelance consultant and a marketeer and whatever else, but just as a resource and a great point of access into kind of what should be, what is going on and what should be going on, is a great place to look. So The Online Rule is his handle, I think, on all major platforms.
That's a very good one. I've definitely come across The Online Rule over the years, and that's a fantastic recommendation. And how about you, Rob? Where can we find you as well as all things First 5 Yards across web and digital and social?
Yeah, it's hopefully quite simple. Either at Rob Givert or at First 5 Yards on all major platforms, and website is www.first5yards.com.
Beautiful. And as you listeners can tell, Rob very much knows what he's talking about and really knowledgeable about the stuff and where we're going, where we're headed, and how to value and monetize these digital opportunities and digital platforms. And Rob, cannot thank you enough for coming on the podcast today and sharing with us your time, your knowledge, your wisdom, your expertise, and all this.
No problem. Enjoyed it. Thanks, family.
Just a great, great episode and chatting and learning from Rob Givert, founder of First 5 Yards. Just awesome, awesome stuff. One of my more favorite episodes we've had in a while, talking about the partnership space, which I'm really interested in, and I think you are too. How do you drive revenue from social? How do you work better with the partnerships team? How do you create content that's good for the partner and good for the fans? Just phenomenal stuff from Rob. Definitely check him out on his social platforms as well and keep up, because he is sharing insight. But thank you again to Rob coming on the podcast today. But that'll do for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJH287. Also, hit me up on LinkedIn, where I post more content. The website, as always, dsmsports.net. And follow along with the podcast on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. Till next time, this is Neil Horwitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.